WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
This is the story of a conflict. It's the conflict between the globalization of amnesia, conformity, and death, and the globalization of rebellion, hope, and memory.
Robin Hood. I'm a 15th century subsistence farmer, and like much of the world, I gain my subsistence from the common land. I in England, water from the common streams, my shelter and food from our common land. But then the rich came and enclosed our common lands. They fenced them in for private gain, and capitalism was born. They separated our communities from our ability to subsist. Many of our people were forced into the cities to work for wages and sell their time to buy the things back that we used to make ourselves. And this model was exported all over the globe. So I took to the woods to join a merry movement in rebellion against these enclosures and to reclaim our commons. And I came here to Ithaca to ask you, will you join us?
Yes!
I am a rebel here to tell you today that the enclosures have not ended. They have new names, names like corporate globalism, the war on terror, and gentrification.
We call this new system of new enclosures empire. It's got many names in many places. Empire is a system of global control that has three pillars: war and occupation, corporate globalization, and the war at home with repression and takebacks. But it seems like there's actually two different kinds of empire. There's a neoconservative Bush unilateral empire, but then it also seems that there's a neoliberal multilateral kind of a Kerry empire. The world is waiting for us to vote out Bush and to do what we can to exercise our ability to try and unelect Bush. But on the other hand, is voting every 4 years for pre-selected, unaccountable politicians that seem to legitimize an empire really enough?
No.
No.
Can we imagine a real democracy where we'd have control over the things that mattered in our neighborhoods, our communities, our schools, hospitals, and the world we leave for our kids?
Yes.
And that might mean voting with our feet, our hearts, our hands, our voices, and our imaginations. Not every 4 years, but every day of the year. Many people would call that direct democracy, where people were directly involved and had a say-so over the things that mattered.
The Globalizing Liberation Roadshow stopped at the Bush Must Go office in Ithaca last week. What you just heard was part of a performance by Bay Area activists David Solnit and Carrie Lambert, dramatizing the burgeoning global democracy movement that is saying no to a commodified world. I spoke with David Solnit about his new book, Globalizing Liberation, which is a compilation of essays on the new radicalism, a movement that brings together many movements that is offering an alternative to the world order of market capitalism. We'll hear that interview in the first hour of the program. In the second hour, a documentary on how people are reviving a very old tradition of direct democracy in America, the town meeting, in an effort to make their voices heard on the issues they care about. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary.
No fat rich man's pony can overtake you. There's not a rider from the east to the west to hold you alive in this dark.
David Solnit has been a participant in various radical social movements for the past 24 years. He brings that experience to bear as the editor of a new book, Globalizing Liberation, which is a collection of essays by many authors on the theory and practice of nonviolent direct action and the new radicalism. I asked him to begin by talking about his own evolution as an activist and organizer.
The journey of activism took me through from the anti-draft movement through anti-nuclear movement, where I became familiar with mass nonviolent direct action, and through that continued using the vehicle of mass nonviolent direct action into Central America, environmental, housing, and just a wide range of movements. 5 years trying to shut down the Nevada test site, organizing in Nevada with the Western Shoshone Native folks. And after a break and after the Zapatista uprising, I started to look for new forms of resistance. And so I spent a part of the last 8 years co-founding a street theater collective called Art and Revolution, and using giant puppets, theater, dance, music, spray can art to try and infuse art and culture into creating new forms of resistance and into revitalizing our movements as the Zapatistas sort of inspired many of us to do around the world in different ways. The Zapatistas are master storytellers, and they simultaneously recognize that there is a dramatic escalation in the global powers that be to enclose or to concentrate more power and wealth quicker than had to happen at any point in history, and that was called corporate globalization. For indigenous campesinos in southern Mexico, what that meant is that the ejido system, the land system of shared common land that they had fought the Mexican Revolution, was going to be taken away by the North American Free Trade Agreement. So they chose that as a point to stage an uprising. And the uprising was a masterfully told story. And so they were both pointing out that the world was changing dramatically, but what inspired us is that they were telling a story about how we could resist in a different way. They were a complete departure from Latin American vanguard guerrilla movements and from most of the dominant forms of trying to change the world from the last century. And that story they told about making change without taking power, about moving forward while constantly asking questions. A lot of those principles inspired people. The ideas of difference, that we didn't have to have a homogeneous movement with a centralized structure or a cookie cutter, one size fits all solutions, was very infectious. And I think the ideas weren't brand new, or they weren't the only ones who had them, but they were, I think, the best storytellers. So for what a lot of us have started to call the new radicalism. They are kind of the creation story of the new radicalism. They told a story that captivated a lot of our imaginations around the world, and then they invited a lot of us from all over the world to come to the jungles in Chiapas and share our stories together. They didn't lay down, here's our 10-point plan, here's the worldwide party we want you to join, but they said, let's share stories and talk about how we're going to change the world. And that one of the structures that came out of that was the People's Global Action Network. That was an international network of grassroots movements for whom the ideas of the Zapatistas resonated. So it was farmers in India, indigenous folks in Bolivia, radical ecologists in England, critical mass bicyclists in San Francisco all went. And the ripples of that, one of the most obvious ripples was the shutdown of Seattle, of the WTO in Seattle several years later. That was organized through the People's Global Action Network, and a lot of us who initiated the direct action part of it were inspired by the Zapatistas. A lot of us had been watching the growing anti-globalization or anti-capitalist movement in Europe, as well as there was a lot of growing movements in the United States, campus-based anti-sweatshop movements, labor-based struggles, Earth First direct action. So what came together was in strong anti-authoritarian and anarchist organizing in the U.S. We've always all known, as the women's movement said, that it's all connected and that we're all up against a similar system. But by creating institutions like the World Trade Organization, they created a focal point where we're able to say, yes, we all have a shared enemy. And that's what the enemy looks like. And so it impacted all of us in different ways, whether you were a small farmer, a student, or an environmentalist. So all of us ended up in the streets of Seattle together. And for those of us in the direct action, we saw it as a huge opening for folks in the U.S. to try and step up to the plate with the rest of the world that had much more developed anti-globalization movements. So what Seattle and the shutdown wasn't, it wasn't the beginning of the anti-globalization movement, it was the beginning, or the global justice movement. It was the U.S. stepping up to the plate and joining the rest of the world. And because of who we were and where we were, it had a huge impact and really broke the facade that there was any kind of a consensus, or what Margaret Thatcher had told us in the early 90s, that there is no alternative to corporate globalization. So we were able to fracture that in the streets of Seattle, and to also articulate sort of a northern version of Zapatismo, creating frameworks, as Zapatista said, a world where many worlds fit. We were able to create actions and convergences where many movements came together, and we didn't always agree on goals or philosophy, but the sum of the parts were so much greater than any individual action or march that it, and the way particularly the direct action folks organized, people were able to see thousands of people self-organized in a directly democratic fashion, making decisions and shutting down a major American city. And that idea was very infectious. But the other piece that was going on is, a lot of us have tried to redefine the anti-globalization or global justice movement, which a lot of us are now calling new radicalism. At the same time that we were in the streets of Seattle, and there were definitely community-based organizations and communities of colors in the streets and in leadership, but much less represented. But at the same time, on the front lines of the anti-globalization or global justice struggle were community-based organizations in communities of color and poor communities, in the workplaces, fighting environmental justice struggles, fighting against prisons and police brutality, at the point at which corporate globalization impacted people's daily lives. So parallel to the summits in Seattle and the protests against the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank in Washington, D.C., and this whole series of mass actions, there was also more and more creative and radical community-based organizations in other communities. And so the whole of this is really what a lot of us are calling the movement of movements. And it was happening not just in the United States, but all over the planet.
Do you think that the new radicalism is different from other movements historically in that it consciously notes that all of these various struggles are connected. What does that mean for the new radicalism?
I think the ideas aren't completely new, but what's new is how popular the ideas have come. They're not just small groups of people having study groups in cafes. I mean, and again, the U.S. is playing catch up with the rest of the world, but these are mass movements of millions of campesinos, workers, people throughout. I mean, mass mobilizations throughout Europe of millions of people in the streets that are articulating a desire for a fundamentally and radically different world. So that's what's different, is that partly that radical ideas have become incredibly popular, partly that through both new technologies and new forms of organizing, our movements are both stronger, more radical, but we're also more connected to each other than at any point in history. I mean, the climax you saw last year on February 15th, in 6 weeks, our movement of movements organized a day of action against the war, and there was something like between 12 and 20 million people mobilizing on every continent, the biggest protest in history. And this was organized through all the networks we've created. In the book Globalized Liberation, I identify five different principles that a lot of our movements seem to have in common.
What are they?
The first one is that they're anti-systemic, that because of the stage of the crisis we're in, a lot of our movements recognize that we can't just attack the symptoms of the disease, that we have to go for a systemic cure to what's wrong in the world, and that by thinking and acting within a anti-systemic framework, our efforts become cumulative. They complement each other instead of competitive, fighting over limited resources and activist attention. The second one is that we use direct action and people power. We've seen in the last 15 years a whole range of governments go down, but also that the idea that people can make change directly themselves and create the world they want themselves and not rely on the institutions that are often at the root of our problem has become more and more a central part of how we change the world. A third one is that making change without taking power, which the Zapatistas first clearly articulated, and it's looking back at the last century where we were always debating between reformers and revolutionaries over what's the best way to seize state power. And then after a century, it wasn't that the leaders of the movement were necessarily corrupt, because so many of those experiments became totalitarian nightmares or betrayals, but that it was the wrong question. Instead of seizing state power, we need to, and our movements are experiment with how do we make changes directly ourselves, and that we can't change the fundamental relations of power by taking over those same institutions. So we're talking about two different kinds of power. A fourth principle is direct democracy, and that's where the two different types of power over that we see in corporations, in governments, hierarchical power, power of domination, as the women's movement defined it, is the old form, and that's what we need to step away from. And the new form of power, Starhawk and others have articulated it in the book and elsewhere, is called power with a horizontal power, where people act democratically and share power. And direct democracy is how we organize in our movements and in the new society we're creating to replace the old one, using power with or horizontal power. In Argentina, they're calling it horizontalism. And the fifth one is called a laboratory resistance, the idea that we can't just repeat old models of change, especially ones that didn't work, but that we have to constantly experiment and use principles of creativity and innovation, and that our actions and our organizing are an experiment in a laboratory of resistance. And with any experiment, it's successful if you evaluate and learn something from it. So thinking of how we organize as constantly being on our toes and innovating has been essential.
In your book, you have essays by many different people from all over the world who are coming at this struggle from various specific directions. How are some of these five principles actually implemented in some real examples?
I'll give you three stories that shows the breadth of these movements, that on the surface they seem very different. There's no common language or political party, but there are those underlying principles. I'm from San Francisco, where I work with Direct Action to Stop the War. The day after the U.S. invaded Iraq, we created a framework through which 20,000 angry Bay Area residents shut down San Francisco's financial district, which is the major artery through which big business and capital flows in and out of the United States on the western U.S. 20,000 people shut down corporations, federal building, government offices, and shut down arteries all over San Francisco, and were able to paralyze the financial district as a form of protest and also as a way of having a people power direct impact on the corporations and big business behind the war. That's one example. Another one is I was invited 2 years ago to go to Argentina in Buenos Aires and work with the neighborhood assemblies and the piqueteros, or unemployed movements, that had all formed in the wake of the economic collapse in the winter of 2001. And that's a movement where people rose up, overthrew five successive governments in a number of months, who were responsible for bringing in the International Monetary Fund, opening up their country to the ravages of corporate globalization, and then watching the banks and global corporate capitalism pull the resources out of that country to where everyone's lost their life savings, people were going hungry. One of the wealthiest countries in South America became one of the poorest. And so the neighborhood assembly organizing, the piqueteros, or unemployed people who shut down highways to demand unemployment relief, the over 100 factories that were taken over and run very efficiently by the employees, that would be another example. And the third one is coming back to the United States in southern Florida, the coalition of Immokalee farm workers. People may have heard of the Taco Bell boycott, but these are a group of immigrant farm workers and low-income workers from southern Florida, mostly Mexican, Guatemalan, and Haitian. And they've taken on the biggest restaurant corporation in the world, Yum Brands, which owns Taco Bell, which buys the tomatoes in which they work in sweatshop field conditions, in some cases in outright slavery, and they've busted at some of the slave rings. And they've used direct action and creative campaigning to push back, to force Yum Brands to begin to negotiate with them and to dramatically improve their working conditions and gain a sense of dignity, while at the same time pursuing a longer-term vision of a dramatically different world and linking to the other movements I just mentioned. So those are three different, very different movements that all are part of the new radicalism, that all share some common principles in the way we organize, but are very different populations in different parts of the world.
Does the new radicalism look different in the United States than other places?
This country is full of people who at different points in history have been known to rise up, get very angry about the situation, and shift things dramatically. I mean, Seattle was a little taste that things can happen very very rapidly and very dramatically. And so we were able to have a big shift happen in a very short time. And I think conditions are very ripe for it. And it's true, our movements aren't quite as strong or as massive as other parts of the world. But on the other hand, because we're in the control room of the bulldozer of the global system we live in, we're able to do a little and have a huge impact. So I personally I think it's an incredible opening to be living in the United States and have access to trying to be inside the heart of the empire and change things. So, and I do think that I've been traveling around, and everywhere I see, there's people in lots of different forms trying to figure out how to change things, and a lot of discontent showing itself. I mean, everything from workers creating worker centers in sweatshops or farm workers communities to hip-hop to, I think, a lot of radical things are happening in non-conventional places. So it may not look like marches and protests, but that doesn't mean there's not dissent and not forms of resistance.
In terms of forms of resistance, what role do you think marches and protests play within a larger scheme of a new vision?
History has always been shifted in the streets, but it's gotten more complicated in that we have to be smarter than we've ever been before. They've tried to take the history of direct action and of people being in the streets to change things, and they tried to inoculate the American people from it, the people in the United States, by creating an idea that protest or protesters are some strange, alien, marginal form. Whereas, you know, if there hadn't been protests in the United States, we'd be a British colony with slavery. All of us would be working in sweatshop conditions, and only propertied white men would have the vote. So they've sort of created a process of amnesia, taking our history away from us, and tried to estrange people from the central form of democratic change in this country. So protest and street resistance is key, but we have to be very smart and try and figure out how to reframe it and get it past people's the obstacles that have been built in people's brains, so that they get it, so that they understand it, and so that they can relate to it. And so a lot of that is rethinking how we communicate with people, stepping back from some of the old forms of protest, and coming up with new ones that can break past those barriers.
Can you give some examples of that?
I mean, I think a lot of hip-hop music and culture has been a form of people protesting. I think MoveOn.org, while it's got very limited demands, has been able to break beyond that and capture people's imaginations and tap into widespread discontent. In the Bay Area, we've recently tried to figure out how to articulate who we are in a way that breaks outside of that protester. So on the one-year anniversary of the war, we had a healthcare, not warfare march, and we had it led by doctors and nurses in uniform. Military families speak out. So trying to humanize it and get beyond the marginal terms of protester or dissident, and making it clear that, you know, if you hold basic values of democracy and equality and justice, that it's social movements that stand up for those values, and that our system is in crisis and is in severe violation of those basic values.
You're listening to an interview with activist and organizer David Solnit. Could you talk a little bit about how you organized the shutdown of the financial district? Were you surprised at what happened?
There was a direct action group that formed maybe 6 months before that started organizing direct action protests against the war. Very small at first, but I think a lot of us recognized all the other anti-war groups were doing a great job at getting people out to have marches, to send letters, but we recognized the gap that we needed to make it very, very politically and economically expensive if the U.S. did go ahead to war, because it seemed like, you know, all of us could see that it seemed almost inevitable that there was such a momentum heading towards that. So we wanted to, because we realized that it didn't start with the war in Iraq, and it won't end with that. That's part of a bigger plan for empire. So we wanted to make it very expensive. We also saw that moment when the U.S. went to war is what we call a psychic break, a point where people's normal expectations of how they behave would be suspended and people might be willing to take an additional step. So recognizing that, we decided that our role in the anti-war movement in the Bay Area would be to put a lot of resources into planning for that moment, that if the U.S. did go to war, we would try and create a very expensive response that the system wouldn't forget. We'd also try and use it as a form of dissuasion, so that the U.S. would know in advance, and we were very public and had press conferences, that if you go to war, we will shut down a major American city. And we had people from all walks of life, community groups, professionals, all kinds of people at press conferences saying, we are going to do this thing if you go to war. And then we created a framework using a lot of the structures of the global justice direct action movement. We encouraged people to organize into affinity groups. We had a spokes council. We had some very basic goals, but we also tried to make, and we could have always done better, but we tried to make space where everybody could feel welcome, where there wasn't a narrow politics or one dominant group. And it was the right thing at the right time. So tons of people in the Bay Area supported it. And when the day came, we had 20,000 people, some of them participating in anti-war marches through the financial district. But a lot of us were in affinity groups, and we divided the city into different areas where there are key intersections, arteries, corporations, and financial institutions. Different groups took on different ones. So on the morning of, everybody knew where they were doing, what they were doing. We had no need for any kind of real coordination that day of. We had a point where people who weren't plugged in could show up, and we would give them brief orientations and send them out. And so at 7 a.m. all over the city, thousands of people sat down in intersections, locked down through plastic pipes, did all kinds. Some people meditated on stairs. Some people did yoga. Some people did civil disobedience at the federal building. People held marches. There's theater. So we really had San Francisco's best stepping up to the plate. And more people gathered and joined. So starting at 7, the police were starting to do mass arrests. By about 10 o'clock, they gave up and actually admitted that we had effectively shut down the city, and they lost control of the city streets the rest of the day. And over that and the next day, we had towards 2,000 people arrested in mass arrests, going to jail. And that the idea caught on, so people would just show up in downtown. They had seen what to do, and people were spontaneously forming into groups and just sitting down and shutting streets down. And then we continued with the campaign of actions for weeks after that. Almost every week we did a different action at a different corporation that was benefiting or involved in the war.
So people were really having fun doing this, it sounds like.
People were having fun. There was Bikes Not Bombs, contingents of bicyclists going around, Bhutto theater groups, a giant brass liberation orchestra. An older taxi cab driver had called on folks who weren't that mobile to bring their cars downtown and stall them or abandon them. So there was all this stuff happening simultaneously. No one will ever know what all happened. And there was a certain amount of police violence, but it was an explicitly nonviolent action, and that sensibility prevailed on our end throughout the day. So there was a certain amount of scuffling, but no major injuries, and it was basically a mass nonviolent citizen uprising. And I mean, it's not really fair to say we organized it. We set up the framework. We announced it to the city, and the people of the Bay Area were the ones who really did it spontaneously.
For people who aren't familiar with direct action and some of the terms you've used, affinity groups and spokes councils, can you talk about what that means and what the significance is of organizing actions in this way?
I mean, the organizing model goes back a ways. Affinity groups comes from the Spanish workers' movement, where they successfully reorganized Spanish society in the 1930s during the Civil War. But it's basically a small, informal group of 5 to 25 people, and spokes councils are the councils through which they coordinate. And it's an effort to organize our movement in the way we like to see society, and trying to keep things human scale, having people be directly involved in the decisions that affect them. And so it's one way we can practice organizing like that in our opposition movements. And we've seen a lot of it carry over to constructive alternatives. We have a lot of workers' co-ops in the Bay Area, community social service agencies that have taken a lot of these skills and models and applied them to positive alternatives. So it's practice for how to reorganize society, but it's also how we organize our movements is key. I put together the book partly to give examples of people who are taking these ideas and applying them not just into bigger international or anti-war struggles, but into day-to-day survival struggles in our communities. So the book has three sections. The first one is called What's the Problem? It looks at our basic problems from a variety of analysis or understandings. The second one is called How to Change Things. It's a lot of strategies applying these principles and looking at some effective new ways at making change in the world. And the final one is called Ideas in Action. And that one looks at housing struggles, anti-prison struggles, farm worker struggles, both in the United States and globally, all the way to national uprisings such as in Argentina or Chiapas. And it looks at how people mix up improving their lives on a day-to-day basis and dealing with the kind of crisis we have to, you know, around trying to keep resources in our community, stop environmental degradation. But how do we do those local struggles, those day-to-day survival struggles, and mix it with a long-term radical vision so that we can simultaneously address our front burner issues, and as we address those, move towards deeper, longer-term radical changes. So one example in San Francisco where we have a housing crisis is the San Francisco Community Land Trust has been in the process of getting control, either buying or taking over housing and turning it over to a land trust. And the idea is that to maintain affordable housing, but do it in a way that is consistent with a radical long-term vision of how our city could be. So the housing that they get is run by a combination of the tenants or the housing owners. So people who move into the affordable housing, they actually own the house. And then the neighborhood creates institutions which own the property that the house is on. And so they jointly make decisions. So the vision is that ultimately you could take over more and more of the city's housing and have it run through a combination of the person who lives in the house and the local community, reorganizing potentially the whole city into a self-managed city. That's one example from here. From Argentina, when I was there, there was over 100 neighborhood assemblies, and they started, initially they started to organize protests in the different neighborhoods against the dictatorship, which they eventually overthrew. Since then, they've started to take over neighborhood spaces and take on running social services for a lot of the different neighborhoods. And the neighborhood assemblies are what they sound like. It's a bunch of neighbors, sometimes dozens, sometimes hundreds, get together in an assembly. It started out in the streets, but as it got colder, people looked for spaces to meet inside. And they would make decisions together about how to take care of the problems. What do they do for the retirees who don't have all the stuff they need? How do they create community centers so they can have some culture and workshops and places to meet? And then they would start to coordinate between neighborhoods called interbarrios, or neighborhood assemblies between all those. So those are two short examples.
What role do you think a certain critical mass of numbers plays in all of this? In other words, what would you have to do? What would you have to get, do you think, to develop enough people participating in an alternative system to, you know, as you mentioned, make San Francisco a self-managed city, to take a place and opt out of the present framework?
I think the idea of making change without taking power is to redefine radical change or revolution as not an incident or a moment where suddenly everything changed, but it's a process of trying to slowly change social relationships so that people have direct say-so over the things that matter. And I think we've seen a lot of, the last decade in Bolivia, in Indonesia, in the Philippines, we've seen people power topple governments. But I think what a lot of people who have been through those very incredible and very important toppling dictators experiences will say is that insurrection is not enough. That, and in this country, you know, it seems like it's hard to imagine, but things can shift dramatically. But unless we have gone through the slow process of creating models of how we could reorganize society and developing those skills to self-manage our own local economies, our own communities, that, you know, maybe. I mean, just envision that Bush does what he threatened to do, that he cancels the elections and stages some type of a power grab, which is to some degree how he got into power in the first place. But imagine he does that. Maybe there's an uprising against it, and perhaps we could take down the government in the United States, as people elsewhere around the world have done. Their power is very fragile, and the vast majority of the people are very opposed to the United States government and its policies. But what would take its place? How would we reorganize our communities? So we've seen in places like Chiapas being one of the more developed ones, where they've actually reorganized their communities and local communities, run their schools, run their local economies, run their community assemblies in a way that makes sense and reflects the kind of world they want to live in. And there's little bit pieces of it in our communities all over the United States. So the challenge is, how can we create a process to keep growing these and also linking these positive alternative institutions with our resistance movements? So when we have our marches and our civil disobedience and our direct actions, we can say a big common no to the system at the root of our problems, but also say many yeses to all the positive solutions that we already have in our communities, and start to point to that. What does a participatory economy look like? What does a directly democratic community look like?
How much do you think that we as individuals have to change inside to do this? Or, you know, do we?
I think we have to dramatically. The United States has a particularly horrible history of, you know, racism and sexism and homophobia. And those are those three things that unite some people call them right wing. What unites the right tends to divide opposition movements. So there's a whole part of that process is not just in building institutions, but trying to unlearn all the different forms of power over. So it's not just hierarchical institutions, but it's also oppressive social relations. And those are the things that people have to do work on and try to unlearn, and unlearn that privilege and balance things out if we're to try and bring together all our communities into that movement, a movement that we need to dramatically shift things. So and a lot of people are doing good work at trying to figure out how to do that personal work and mix it up with our political work. So in the Bay Area, we do lots of unlearning racism workshops. People do work on trying to figure out how to work better together. So there's a whole personal and psychological piece of the system is not just something outside us in Wall Street and Washington. It's also colonized our brains, so the struggle is both internal and external.
When you talk about colonizing our brains, sometimes in talking to people who are not involved as activists, and they have a sense that things are corrupt, now the government doesn't care about me. That's the kind of the way it's always been. And I can't imagine what I would do to change that. That seems to be a prevalent thing that many people say. What do you think gives a person hope or gets them to change their view about whether it's worthwhile to fight from your experience?
I think the problem is not so much what people don't know, but what they do know, and that there's a lot of mythologies or stories, going back to stories again, that control how we think and limit people's possibilities. So most people in this country can't really imagine dramatic change happening, partly because our history has been taken away from us, and partly because there's the dominant stories that are being told are not ones in which we have power, or the one opportunity we have to change things is voting between two fairly similar political parties. So there's a article in the book called Decolonizing the Revolutionary Imagination, and that's, I think, what we have to do is we have to tell other stories, and it's not so much just deconstructing the facts, but actually showing and telling examples of people who have been successful around the world, to partly inspire people, but also to show concrete examples. There's You talked a little bit about hope, and the dictionary defines hope as desire, as in desire for a better world, plus the expectation that those desires can be realized. So the confidence in realizing that our desires can be realized comes from actually telling people the stories of successful experiments or successful struggles around the world. I mean, those of us who are radicals or progressives or alternative minded in the United States, you wouldn't know it in this country, but we're part of a global majority. Most people in the world agree with our basic values and a lot of our basic direction. And the people in power in the United States are actually the extremist fringe, but somehow because we're up against the biggest propaganda machine in history with the most resources, that's been turned on its head to where those of us who, you know, apply common sense and say people should have the things they need, the people affected by a decision should make them, and very basic common sense ways of structuring society, we're made to feel like fringe folks, and the freaky neoconservatives and even neoliberals are placing themselves, manipulating us into thinking they are the mainstream.
You're listening to an interview with David Solnit, author of a new book, Globalizing Liberation.
Well, you sound actually very hopeful.
I mean, I am hopeful, and I spend a lot of my time engaging with movements around the world, finding out what's happening, and knowing that our movements everywhere are stronger than they've ever been, that we're better connected, and that there's massive examples of how people have reorganized their societies. It gives me a lot of hope. How many people here know that the people of Bolivia, when their government and corporations tried to privatize their natural gas, they rose up and threw their government out. Their president fled to Miami. I mean, and so those are our allies all over the world. And the U.S. government's power, the empire's power, is the most fragile it's been at any point in history. They're massively overextended. They have very little international support. And the key ingredient to realizing the possibility of dramatic positive transformation in the world is for the people in the United States to step up to the plate and join with the rest of the world. And part of that is becoming literate in people power. That's how the people in Bolivia threw out their government. That means, you know, we need to go on strike. We need to shut down cities. We need to organize ourselves to imagine, instead of, if the U.S. engaged in another war, imagine instead of just San Francisco, if we shut down every city in this country. And a lot of us are talking about the day after the elections, there's a national call for a day of action. And imagine if, for example, there's overt corruption or they try to postpone the election, maybe that's time where American people can show their stuff and actually shut down every city in the country. Or if Bush gets elected, maybe that's time to start flexing some people power muscles and showing that another Bush presidency will be met with widespread non-cooperation and resistance in the streets. Or even if Kerry's elected, it can be a time to celebrate that it wasn't a Democratic Party victory, but a people's victory, and that we're going to be applying the same pressure to Kerry that we did to the Bush administration to try and win that better world that we all want.
You're also going to be heading down to New York City, where the Republican convention will take place at the end of this month. What's being planned there, and why do you think that it's important that people participate and engage that?
I think what's the Republican National Convention happening from August 29th to September 2nd in New York City is going to be one of those historic moments. I've been telling a lot of my friends, as I did around Seattle, that this is a time to step up to the plate, and the whole world is actually watching. I think what we're going to see is a superpower confrontation. The New York Times, when the U.S. was building up for war in Iraq, they said there are now superpowers. There's no longer just one superpower of the United States, but there's a second one, and that's called global civil society. That's our movement of movements around the world. So our movements around the world, I mean, with this in the United States, because we live here, stepping up to the plate in the front, are going to confront the Bush administration and its ambitions of empire. And I think it'll be a very important moment, and I think it's an opportunity for us, for us to realize a lot of possibilities and try and intervene in the very narrow debate of the presidential elections. A lot of us are hoping to intervene in both, exercise some people power by taking the streets and marching and engaging in civil disobedience, but also with a very clear message that voting is not, don't, to not just vote, that voting is not enough. We need to unelect Bush, but we also need to build movements and communities that can be a counterweight to not just Bush, but also Kerry, because it didn't begin with Bush and it won't end with Kerry, the problems we face.
Are you familiar with the community gardens movement in New York City?
Very much so. And
this seems that an example of the type of building of infrastructure, and it has been ferociously assaulted. And I think this is an interesting thing because it is, on the face of it, such an innocent and nice thing. People making gardens, and the people making these gardens have been met with brutality. Can you talk about this and what it means?
Oh, I've been talking with Aresh from More Gardens, who's one of the groups that organizes to defend community gardens in the Bronx and Harlem, all over New York. And they've faced massive attacks on their gardens and their ability of neighbors to get together. And they'll be doing stuff in the streets around the RNC. We're in dialogue about having a book, Globalized Liberation book party at one of the gardens in the Lower East Side. But I've been traveling around the country talking about the book, doing events with co-authors, and we do popular education. I dress up as Robin Hood and talk about how sort of one of the roots of what's going on now. As Robin Hood, I'm a 15th century English farmer who subsists off the land like people all over the world have. And then in the 1500s, the rich enclosed my land and fenced it in, separated me from my ability to subsist off the land and get the things I need, forced me to work for wages to buy the things that I used to provide for myself. And that process of enclosures, of separating us from our ability to subsist as communities, is not something that actually stopped in Europe or stopped when they brought that model and colonized the rest of the planet. It's something that's actually escalated in the last few years with corporate globalization, both which has a domestic side and an international side. And so they're enclosing our time at work. They're enclosing our space, whether it's community gardens or gentrification. And they're enclosing so many aspects of our earthly commons, the things that belong to everybody. Privatizing water from Bolivia to unsuccessfully in Stockton near where I am. So the community gardens are a real example of, in resistance to this enclosure, their ability to try and corporatize our lives. People get together and they create new commons, new communal spaces where we get to take care of each other and create the things we need and make life better. And so a lot of what we're talking about is we have to create more and more new commons and resisting their ability to enclose those things.
Now, all of these corporations are filled with thousands or millions of people that work for them and assist them in reaching these goals, since that's how they earn their keep. What about those people? What do you think it takes for them to withdraw their compliance?
I think that's happening in a lot of different parts of the world where people are resisting these new enclosures or this corporate globalization. I mean, I think it's partly people recognizing that power isn't something that a few people, the CEOs, hold and other people are subject to, but it's actually a fragile relationship. And we step back from it, we can watch it change or force changes, or sometimes watch their power crumble. And there's a wide range of examples of people successfully resisting corporations. One piece in the book comes from the POCLAD, which is the Program on Law, Corporations, and Democracy, which are the folks who have been doing all the education about how corporations are actually just a human-made invention that we used to charter. We back in the 100 years ago, a corporation to operate in your state, they'd have to get a corporate charter. They still do. And that charter could be revoked so that corporations were kept on a tight leash. If they messed up, if they broke the laws, people would say, you can't operate in our state. And so there's a bunch of places in Arcata, California, resisting chain stores in Pennsylvania, resisting toxic hog farms. People are starting to exercise that corporate charter and say, if you misbehave, you can no longer operate in our community. And so I think what we need to do is take that one step farther and say, it's very clear that corporations as an institution are fundamentally and structurally incapable of meeting our community's needs. So if we, as we used to charter corporations, we can then uncharter them and think about chartering new forms of organization like co-ops, workers' cooperatives, municipal institutions to take care of our needs. So to me, I'm excited about the idea of trying to be ambitious and imagine our communities without corporations, imagine our states without corporations. What would it take to build a movement that could do that?
What do you hope to do by compiling this book, Globalized Liberation?
Two things. One of them was to define the new radicalism, to define this movement of movements that I believe has practices and experience within it, which provide a wealth of experience, theory, and ideas about how to get out of the current mess and to get to the root of it, not just to do band-aid solutions, single issue, or stopgap solutions. The other was to provide a manual for activists and people who want to be change agents in the world. So it's a book written not by academics or intellectuals, but it's written almost exclusively by people who have been part of these experiments, these struggles to try and change the world, and have explained how did they organize that uprising. Farm workers in Florida explain how they use popular education and leadership development in their struggles. So it's a book by practitioners, for practitioners, about how to uproot the system and build a better world. And for me, it's also an experiment in that laboratory of resistance. It's culling a lot of the best thinking from the last 10 years of movement experiments, and it's an experiment to see if we can get smarter. I've been encouraging people to use the book as written, for people to use as a study guide, to form study groups so that we can have a sort of popular counterbalance to all the establishment think tanks and foundations. So I'm hoping that it will spread around the world like dandelion seeds or like fire in dry grass and inspire people and make a common sense social revolution in the United States as part of a global one.
What do you think is common about our problems, since you have a section that is addressed, that addresses identifying the problem or defining the problem? What do you think we in the United States have in common with other places in identifying or defining or being beset with the problem?
I mean, when I spent time in Argentina, I have some relatives in Buenos Aires. When the IMF imposed economy collapsed and all the banks pulled their money out of the country and everybody's life savings, including my uncle's, was only worth a third of what it had been, and they had spent their whole life collecting for their retirement and for their families. Those banks weren't Argentine banks, they're global banks, many of them based in the United States. So, you know, and those are the same banks like Citibank and others that do predatory lending in our inner cities, that fund massive ecologically destructive projects throughout our regions. So we're more explicitly than ever, we're all up against the same global economic system and the same principle of power over in all our communities around the world. And people are recognizing that and starting to join together. The world is in a crisis, and as has often been said, there's two parts of that. One of that is danger, and that there's danger that if things go on their current path, you know, of endless war, increasing poverty, misery, ecological collapse. That's very real and facing us and very, you know, very daunting.